Let's be inspired today. The storm isn't done. But let's be inspired. When my daughter Jamie was a little girl and she heard the story of school segregation for the first time, she came to me with a question. "Mom, I'm Korean American. If I'd lived then, back when schools were segregated, would I have gone to the white school or to the colored school?" What a question. The lines we humans draw, as if there is some defensible logic to Jim Crow. The comedian Trevor Noah grew up in South Africa at a time when his parents' relationship was illegal. He recalls that under apartheid, Chinese were considered black and Japanese were considered white. It didn't have anything to do with skin color. It was that the government wanted to establish better trade relations with Japan. So I told my little girl that I didn't know the answer to her question, that segregation was so wrong, it confused lots of people with questions that shouldn't ever need to be asked. The story of segregation in America is the story of the color line, the legally supported distinction among people based on skin color. A distinction that in its origins and its consequences created different legal rights based on skin color. The color line first appeared in America in Virginia in 1691 in a law passed by the Virginia legislature. Now, at the time in the colony of Virginia, there were only 15,000 citizens. Only 6,000 of them were white. More, 9,000 were forced laborers, who for the most part were subjected to brutal living and working conditions. And although some were theoretically indentured servants who could win their freedom after 7 years, that was far from reality, as debt was piled onto debt. And others were slaves captured in Africa and brought to America, and in many respects, their experience of forced labor was the same. Of all of these 9,000 forced laborers, only 2,000 had dark skin. The other 7,000 had white skin. So here are two important things. First, rebellions. The late 1600s, were a time of notorious rebellions by forced laborers, both slaves and indentured servants. Virginia's legislators were aware of these worldwide rebellions, as well as of rebellion by individual forced laborers in the colony of Virginia. So Virginia's free citizens were vastly outnumbered during a time of widespread revolution of forced workers. And they were worried about losing control. So they hit upon the idea of creating what is a so-called yeoman class of workers. They'd still be forced laborers, but they wouldn't sympathize with non-yeoman forced workers. That was the plan. When they looked at the 9,000 forced laborers in the colony at the time, the legislators saw an easy way to create a distinction, the color line. The 2,000 black workers could become the despised underclass. It was a plan. The second important thing, marriage. In Virginia and all around the world, Marriages between people of dark skin and light skin were commonplace. It wasn't wrong. It wasn't against the law. Often, marriage between masters and slaves occurred, and the landowners cherished the children of those unions. They cherished their children. Words like mulatto did not exist. But the Virginia legislators, as they saw color to be an easy way to make distinctions among the forced workers and the new yeoman class, realized that if light-skinned and dark-skinned people intermarried, the distinction would soon become impossible. So they decided to pass a law to prevent marriage between black people and white people. They defined black as someone with any dark-skinned heritage, a single drop of African blood. They thought that if there wasn't a personal connection between the 7,000 white laborers to children and grandchildren of color, then those yeomen would not unite with black laborers to overthrow their masters. The color line distinction was unique to America until South Africa created apartheid in 1948. The result was that from 1700 on, American courts began to rule that a child with any degree of dark skin must be a slave, while a child with white skin must be free. Now, in other countries that didn't have this color line distinction, the courts would rule that a child of any color whose origins were unknown was presumed to be born free, unless proven to be born into slavery. So those other countries had a different rule because they had substantial populations with mixed color heritage and no legal rule against intermarriage. Relationships of love and family barred in Virginia made a difference in the law in these other countries. In the United States, we see the consequences of this presumption that anyone with brown or black skin must be a slave. The Jim Crow laws segregated the water fountains, the swimming pools, seats on the bus, and seats in the best schools. And these are a consequence not merely of slavery, but of the color line created intentionally in 1691. Uniquely in the United States, color became vitally important. It wasn't until 1967, in the case of Loving against Virginia, that the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the law against intermarriage between blacks and whites. From 1691 to 1967, the deliberate choice of a white minority of Virginia settlers in the late 1600s created a lasting distinction based on color. They did it to oppress and suppress one group of forced laborers with the hope of winning the color-based loyalty of the other group of forced laborers. Their deliberate choice is at the root of the insidious presumptions of racism. Their deliberate choice is why my little girl, contemplating her Asian features, wondered whether she would have gone to the white school or the colored school. In scientific reality, the color line is nonsensical and meaningless. But it's had enormous political and social impact in 1691, in our history, and still today. the civil rights movement. The 1963 March on Washington marked the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Martin Luther King called the Emancipation Proclamation a great beacon light of hope for millions of slaves. A century later, though, Americans, he said, were still crippled by the shackles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. The equality that was implied in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, what King called a promissory note for every American, wasn't yet a reality. King said that America has defaulted on that promissory note, insofar as citizens of color are concerned. The problems that King grappled with in 1963 had several aspects. First, many laws created a structural bias that kept people of color from equal citizenship, the Jim Crow laws. Second, many white people who saw the unfairness of the Jim Crow laws didn't recognize unfair application of other laws that were fair laws. Three, many whites consciously held opinions that demeaned and dehumanized people of color. And four, many more whites, even people who wished to be unbiased, were unaware of their unconscious assumptions that caused them to draw false and demeaning conclusions about people of color. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 successfully changed the unfair laws. It ended the legal Jim Crow, but it couldn't change beliefs and assumptions that inevitably led to the unfair application of other laws. America couldn't legislate the conscious and unconscious assumptions of the white majority. The legacy of the color line isn't something we can easily rewind. Now here we are, half a century later. We've seen Congress apologize for slavery. We've seen a black man elected president. We've seen him in the White House with his black wife and his black children. And we've also seen the rise of outspoken white supremacists. We've seen a vast increase in hate crimes based on color and religion, national origin, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Thanks to smartphones with their video cameras, we've seen repeated incidents of the use of excessive force against black Americans. Thanks to Facebook and Twitter and fake news, anyone can send any message to any audience and have it go viral in less than a day. Into this volatile mix, we add the widespread availability of firearms and the most divisive election that any of us can remember. What would Martin Luther King say? He's already said, "Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred." He's already said, somehow this situation can and will be changed. He's already said, let us not wallow in the valley of despair. As we look at the road ahead, we foresee many challenges to our shared hope for justice, fairness, and equal personhood for all Americans. But let this not be a time of despair. Despair pushes us down into that darkness of do nothing, of give up now, of let me be. Whatever our cultural heritage, our national origin, our ancestral heritage, our religious beliefs, our cultural upbringing, our sexual orientation or gender identity, we are Unitarian Universalists. In this faith, we covenant, we promise to respect the inherent worth of every person. We promise to bring justice, equity, and compassion to all our relationships. We cannot fulfill these promises if we allow ourselves to sink into despair. We cannot live with integrity if we allow our hearts to fill with bitterness, resentment, and rage. Martin Luther King faced exactly this challenge. And as hard as it may be for us to believe, King faced it under circumstances that were much more challenging than ours today. In 1963, there was no Civil Rights Act. In 1963, there was no Voting Rights Act. In 1963, America had never imagined that a person of color could be elected president and then reelected to a second term. In 1963, there was a kind of smugness among those who openly clung to ideas of white supremacy. There was, in fact, in 1963, a certainty that Barack Obama was impossible. Today, we've seen a much better America than Martin Luther King ever experienced. But we've also seen the backlash of shock and anger that a black man's presidency has brought to our nation. That backlash was open and visible during the election, and it's active and energized today. I ask myself, what really did I expect? Did I expect that the 19th century slogan of progress onward and upward forever had finally begun its utopian fulfillment? Did I expect that purveyors of hate and shame would simply roll over and let us glide smoothly into a post-racial, post-hate America? So I speak now to the America that believes in equal rights, that cherishes religious freedom, that knows its own history as a nation of immigrants, that warm-heartedly engages diversity daily at school, at work, on the streets, and when ordering carry-out food. So let me make a slight detour into food. Consider the millions of voters, the millions of citizens of all colors and national origins who cheerfully befriend one another at their favorite restaurants and food trucks. Let me just say, here in Columbus, I celebrate the wonderful ethnic diversity of people from many nations and the fabulous food that is part of their many cultures. From falafel to masala dosa, tacos to mapo tofu, kebabs to corn dogs, the German sausage truck at Weisheimer and High, and the Salvadoran pupusería truck on the Dublin-Granville Road. It's all here. It's all part of my culture. It's all part of the culture of Columbus. It's all part of America's culture. And even though purveyors of hate can peddle fear and fake news, they cannot compete with the American love of ethnic food. So I say, there is hope for America. If Martin Luther King were here today, he would say that the last 50 years of history have hewn out of the mountain of despair not merely a stone of hope, but an extremely large rock of optimism. He would look around at the Fusion Coalition, which joins in a single cause of justice, not only those who are concerned about the illegitimate fruits of the color line, but all who care about the welfare of human beings and the meaning of participatory democracy. Martin Luther King would see visible expressions of hate and tell us that they aren't nearly as prevalent as when he marched on Washington in 1963. He'd see the integrated schools and restaurants and hotels and lunch counters. He'd see that restrooms are for everyone now, even if we're still struggling to clarify the right of every person to use the one that matches their gender identity. Martin Luther King would agree that discrimination of any kind is just another false distinction, the color line drawn with different crayons. He'd see, too, that the way that our color bias of his time has expanded in our time to religious bias, and he'd bring his soul force to bear against the oppression of Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs. Martin Luther King was a champion of reproductive justice. He'd be astonished at how far we've come. But he'd also see the need to ensure that all families have access to reproductive health care and the right to self-determination in family planning. Martin Luther King, deeply aware of the savage inequalities in education and healthcare 50 years ago, today would continue to speak and act to ensure that every child has an equal start in life. When I look at my children's generation, my young adult kids and their friends, I notice their easy, commonplace assumptions that all of us are human beings with inherent worth, even if race, religion, and culture shape us differently in interesting ways. My daughter rolls her eyes at people who think she has Chinese ancestry as she orders Korean carryout from chains that didn't even exist when she was a child. Trevor Noah hosts the preeminent comedy show in America and jokes about how he was born a crime. They are the future. Martin Luther King said in 1963 that we cannot walk alone. It's true. It's true today. We are tied in a mutual network of inescapable mutuality. Injustice anywhere is still a threat to justice everywhere. And the moral arc of the universe is long, but it still bends toward justice. King's words are part of our heritage, part of our history, part of our culture. They are also part of our future. These words are words we believe in our bones. These are words our children and their children understand without explanation. The wheels on the bus go round and round, and all the little children know Rosa's story, They expect to be judged by the content of their character. This is hope. Yes, King's work is not done. His dream is still incomplete. It's a long arc. But here we are. It's our work now. It's our dream. Now we answer the call of love. Now we rise in the cause of justice. Now we respond to hate and dehumanization with soul force. Soul force. Bring it!